who you are and where you're from?
Yeah, so Tanya Machin from the University of Southern Queensland.
What do you know about APAC?
It's our accrediting body, and all of our programs have to be APAC accredited, right from our undergrad through to our postgrad. There are four levels. Do you want me to go on?
No, it's okay. You've passed the test.
I'm Chelsea Hyde. I'm from the University of Melbourne. I know a bit about APAC. I know that they're responsible for accrediting our courses, and we've got an accreditation next year. So you're quite familiar with APAC.
Yeah, sure. So Associate Professor Zoe Hazelwood, and I'm here from QUT up in Brisbane. Quite a lot, but only from the perspective of the accreditation process that we've gone through for our courses and are currently in the process of preparing paperwork for. So, yeah.
Okay, so I'm John Roos. I'm from the Australian College of Applied Psychology in Melbourne. About APAC,
yep.
I know a lot about APAC. I'm a career psychology academic, and so I've been involved in numerous APAC accreditation exercises for at least the last 30 years. So I've got a pretty good understanding of what APAC does and how APAC is organised, and I've got, I'd like to think, a pretty good understanding of the accreditation requirements.
So I'm Joe Paparo. I'm a clinical psychologist, senior lecturer and postgraduate psychology trainer from Macquarie University. We've just gone through our APAC accreditation cycle this year, so I feel like APAC and I are old friends at this point. So very much aware of the central role that APAC plays in the accreditation of psychology programs.
Okay. Yeah. And what do you think about this? Be honest.
I think that we've benefited from the sort of loosening of terminology and some of the changing wording of competencies or standards, that kind of stuff. But that also is a bit of a double-edged sword. And I think at the moment one of our sort of issues is that we try to seek some sense of certainty as to what to, and whether our interpretation of something is correct. And it's very hard to get somebody to actually say, this is, that will be okay. It comes back to, well, it's all about the way that you make your case, and which, again, I can also see how that would be the case. But I think sometimes the idea of being a little bit more hands-off makes things more anxiety-provoking. Yeah.
Yeah, so I actually think APAC as an accrediting body is actually really good. I think the standards that we have are quite helpful when designing programs and trying to find out the key topics and concerns and big ideas, if you like, around psychology and what they are and how they can be embedded.
I think APAC have a very important role, and I know that accreditation is something that creates a lot of stress for academics, but it should, because we need to make sure that our students are properly trained and protecting the safety of the public. So I think it's good that the accreditation process happens, and being at conferences like this is brilliant in seeing how other people are doing things and meeting those accreditation requirements. So it's invaluable being able to connect with colleagues in that way.
Oh, I think APAC serves a very, very important role in the profession. I think along with the APS and HOTSPUR and APAC and Registration Board, I think it's really essential. I mean, that's its role. I've got some personal issues with some of the accreditation rules and regulations and so on, but I think that ignoring that, the overall role of APAC is absolutely critical to both the profession and to the discipline.
I think that APAC have a very hard job to ensure that all the psychology programs across all the levels of tertiary education are meeting the requirements of the requisite knowledge and skills for the graduates that we are servicing. So I think that there's been a lot of developments, and I think that there's a hard balance to strike between providing guidelines that enable some flexibility on the behalf of the higher education provider to service the students that they are servicing the way that they think they best can be serviced, as well as trying to uphold a consistent standard. And I think that's a balance that they try to strike really well.
When it comes to the standards, what do you find are the pain points to implementing the standards?
Yes, I think the cultural responsiveness one has been, I think, the one most people have struggled with. It's great that there's the guidance note, that there's been a lot of feedback on that. Pat Dudgeon and her IEPAP group have been great. Dawn has done some sessions, and in our psychology education interest group we've run a round table on them as well, so that people can come along and understand more about it as well.
To be honest, I don't think we mean it. We don't have any issues in that, like, really, like, obviously, like that. It's little things that have to do with, like, definitions and stuff, like how particular do we have to be about things. So I suppose if I think about things like we've got a packaged 3 and 4 year course, so Masters of Clinical Psych, for example, and trying to get a sense of who's allowed to mark stuff for, you know. And when I approached APAC, the response I sort of get was, well, so long as you feel that you've got suitably qualified people and blah blah blah. And I asked a fairly specific question and got not very specific response. And what was the other one recently as well? Whether or not the number of hours on the first internship placement, which has said has to be minimum 180, had to be client hours or could include non-direct client hours as well. Again, still, that actually got referred to somebody else who hasn't actually managed to get back to us yet. So I suppose it's some of those kind of not wanting to be in breach based on the specifics that could be fixed very easily. That's the pain point sort of stuff for us. The actual competencies or the guidelines themselves, I think they're good. I think they cover, you know, a lot of really good stuff. And I'm really pleased to see that there's the possibility that the next lot are going to include things like a focus on deliberate practice and a focus on self-care in registered psychologists that is going to come through from ARPA and APAC. So, yeah.
I think sometimes it can be the uncertainty of whether the approach that an institution is taking is actually consistent with the guidelines. And so needing to have a little bit of faith in our own capacities to evaluate that. In particular, some of the issues that have come up in recent years, like needing direct client hours across programs for postgraduate study, and also navigating some of the other placement-oriented standards, which have required significant flexibility and shifts in the context of the widespread disruption to placements, firstly with COVID-19 and still the recovery of the sector. I think at the moment it's in meeting the cultural sensitivity requirements in the updated standards, that, you know, people are very much keen to see how other universities are doing that, and also I know from my perspective we're wanting to make sure that we're benchmarking appropriately with other courses. And so, again, conferences like this are great to make those connections so that we can see, you know, what other universities are doing, to make sure we're up to scratch.
Let me say they've improved. So I think the move to competency-based standards has been a dramatic thing. I think sometimes the pain points are to try to incorporate absolutely everything in that's required to be included in there. I think some of the pain points are lack of specificity and clarity, where you might believe you are doing something right, but you will get a feedback from APAC saying you're not doing it right, and you'll say, well, how should we do it? And the answer is, well, not that way, right? So it doesn't sort of give you much direct, explicit guidance and all that sort of stuff. I think one of the other things is that certain topics and areas tend to go in waves and trends and be emphasized. For example, at the moment, benchmarking is a really big thing. It's never been a particularly big thing in my previous experiences with APAC, but now it is. So now we're all madly rushing to get better at benchmarking and so on. So there's just things do go in waves, things do go in trends, and that can be sometimes a little hard to pick up because it's not sort of explicitly stated. The same thing with cultural relevancy. That's now a very strong element of APAC guidelines, which is absolutely fine. But you know, that causes people to have to really start to make changes, because previously we may not have had that recognition and that presence and cultural relevancy in our content, and that makes us really think about what we're going to do. So that's a challenge. It's a challenge to get up to those points.
Another one that we're finding people have a little bit of difficulty with is how to design an appropriate research project. What's your honours experience?
Yeah, so I used to be the honours program director at one stage, and I agree that what is an appropriate honours project is a big question for lots of reasons. Obviously, we don't want to give students projects that are out of scope and that they can't succeed in during their honours year. So I think that that's important. I think traditionally people and universities, and certainly just talking to colleagues, they've tended to focus on quantitative projects, and all of their students did exactly the same. So it might have been a mediation or a moderation, and that was it. That was all the students could do. And I don't think that's what is intended there. I think that our students need to do a range of research projects, and we need to be flexible enough to go with that. So some guidance maybe around what that scope is probably helpful, only so that there would be consistency across universities, so that we don't have, so there's a level playing field for students, because they don't necessarily stay with that university. They may move on in postgraduate studies to other universities, and we don't want them disadvantaged.
Research projects, I do like the changes that have taken place, for example, around, say, I won't use the ACAP level nomenclature, but just the changes in honours research project, I think is good. I think the more flexibility around that, I think the flexibility around the postgraduate research projects is good. So I think that the way that research is... One thing I do find is interesting is that in all of the APAC documentation, the word scholarship is never mentioned. Okay, the word research is mentioned over 30 times in the accreditation guidelines and the evidence book. And that's fine. The word scholarship is never mentioned. And yet scholarship, which can be defined in many different ways, but which encompasses research, is a very important skill we want students to develop. So I would like to see a move away from the explicit use of the term research, more to a broader use of the term scholarship, incorporating research.
I do a lot of research supervision at an honours level. I am primarily working in the master's program, and we are someone who, we are a course that just recently removed the need to do a thesis from our course. As obviously still have research, but made it in other ways. But in terms of honours research projects, I've done a lot of those, lots, like 50, 60 of them probably over the years. Yeah, and find them to work quite well. I think the students wouldn't have that experience if they weren't, like, because they wouldn't have it in an undergrad level because of the need for a longer period of time to really embed themselves into a research project, which I quite like.
Yes, well, at our institution, we still have quite a considerable research project for our master's level. It's 25% of the course. But what we like about the updated APAC standards is that there is that flexibility there in terms of the type of project that students do. So we've definitely got more that are doing systematic reviews or meta-analyses, even N equals one case designs for their research. So I like that the new standards provide greater flexibility and opportunity for what the students do for that research component, because it's very, you know, difficult as it is at honours level, at master's level, to complete an extensive research project in a limited time. So we appreciate that there is the options there.
I certainly think it's an area of hot debate at the moment. I'm looking forward to one of the presentations from Melissa Davies later today on tomorrow on that topic. I think that definitely there's a lot of misunderstanding on what is enough to meet the standard, and also keeping that in step with what professional psychologists will actually, in an applied and translational sense, be using in terms of their research skills and competencies in their future practice. But I certainly think that there are a lot of innovative ideas out there that are now being shared amongst different programs for how to meet that, and trying to make this as applied as possible for our students.
Also wonder, what's your experience with cultural responsiveness? It's obviously been a journey for a lot of providers.
It has. I think we could probably do things better. I think a lot of people could do things better. We had a keynote yesterday from somebody who was talking, with a lot of really great ideas about how to be more culturally aware and have a greater presence in that respect. My thing at the moment, in fact, is actually trying to identify how we can encourage more in First Nations people to want to come in and do our master's program or to study psychology, full stop. And I do wonder whether that's, I don't know whether that's because of a lack of cultural responsiveness or if that's just a lack of, well, I don't really know, to be honest, but I'm not aware of the literature in that space. So I think for us, it's probably going to be about trying to encourage more students to come in. And if there's things that we can do in the form of being more culturally aware and sensitive and et cetera, then, and safe, cultural safety, then I would like to see that happen, definitely.
I think it's another area that obviously is a big debate and some great presentations here at AusPlat this year around that exact topic. I think that it's been very much a learning curve, and I think it really is showcasing not only the gaps that our students have and the gaps that we're trying to fill and imbuing them with those the knowledge and skills required to work in a culturally safe and responsive way, but also is highlighting the gaps that we as educators have in feeling comfortable and confident in being able to do that, and how can we engage our Indigenous colleagues as partners in that process in a way that really genuinely co-designs our curricula.
Any thoughts about what psychology education is going to look like in 5 or 10 years' time?
Oh, that's the question, isn't it? I suspect that at the heart of it, it will be exactly what we've got now. We need passionate educators who want to engage with learning and teaching. I think we could do better in terms of understanding some of the educational principles, so things like constructive alignment, making sure our programs are designed with that in mind. I think that that would be really good. And while we can do lots of things in psychology, those things could probably be done better. But ultimately, I think psychology education is going to look the same. We're still going to have on-campus classes. We're still going to have online classes. That's not going to change. I think there'll be more flexibility and for students, which is a good thing.
Maybe I need to be asked after I listen to the next keynote about AI. Do I have thoughts? To be honest, I probably am too focused in on just trying to dot my I's and cross my T's now. I would like to see us being more, having the institutions be able to make a lot more of the decisions for themselves. But in terms of, what they... So I suppose a bit more of a hands-off kind of accreditation process, but also still acknowledging that accreditation is really very important in order to ensure the standards of the industry. Honestly, I don't know, because there's too many different things floating around. I think there's the idea of digital technology, there's the idea of cultural sensitivity, cultural safety. There's, I think the... The idea that interns, psychologists and extern psychologists are struggling financially, to be honest, what I would love to see would be for provisional psychologists to be allowed to have Medicare numbers and to be able to get rebates for their clients through the Medicare system. Because I think as a university provider, with a teaching clinic, that would just open up so many possibilities for us in terms of being able to offer paid opportunities for our interns. I think that the financial crisis that students, particularly, I mean, both undergrad and postgrad, but obviously I'm thinking that I work in the postgrad space, the struggles and stresses and strains that they go through and what they have to give up in some cases, eating for 3 meals a day to actually be setting forth in this profession, it shouldn't have to be that way. It really shouldn't. So, yeah, I'd like to see something done in that space.
I think we're going to be seeing a lot more online education, and I think that's really exciting because we need to train more psychologists. We're so in demand, and so we need to be more creative in how we're offering our programs and our courses to reach all parts of Australia and regional and remote areas as well. So I think that's pretty exciting.
Well, I mean, this is why we come to these conferences, to really sort of see where it's going to be. I think that psychology education will change at a number of different levels. I mean, I think that we've already seen some big changes in the accreditation pathways. You know, we're now seeing the move away from explicit two-year master's programs more towards a single master's program, and then what I call area of endorsement bridging type programs. I think that will become a much more common model, because I think going forward, I think people will have an understanding that two-year master's programs are very expensive, they're very difficult, whereas to take a 50-year program, you can take a lot more students into it. And with a bridging, with a bridging program, you don't need to have the resources, both human and material, to be able to deliver that. So I think that model will become more and more common. I think another common model that we'll see will be the combined fourth year, fifth year model, post 3 years. So rather than honours, a packaged model that consists of a 2 year master's, where the first year is effectively the honours and the second year is effectively the fifth year. I think that will become more common, a more Euro-Sci type of model. But I think in undergraduate, I think what we'll see is we'll start to see the impact of benchmarking and the impact of cultural awareness really starting to have a strong presence in undergraduate education, and reflection. I think that's going to be another thing that really will start to push through over the next 5 to 10 years.
That's great. That's very valuable.
No worries.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
I think it's a very exciting time for psychology education. I think that there is a lot of talk about ways that we can be more agile in responding to imperatives to boost the psychology workforce in this country and reduce some of the bottlenecks from higher education through to cultivating safe, effective, ethically practicing practitioners. And I think that's the real focus for education. How can we respond to the community and industry imperative to be able to meet that need to have more clinicians out there servicing vulnerable people in our community?
Fantastic. Thank you very much.